Hello and welcome to I Am The Egg Pod, hosted by me, Chris Shaw. The Egg Pods take a jaunty stroll through Pepperland, discussing the Beatles and solo Beatle albums with a potpourri of delicious guests. In this episode, it's a welcome return to friend of the podcast, journalist, broadcaster and 1960s aficionado, Samira Ahmed.
I was alive in the 60s, just.
Yeah, just.
Do you want to hear my notes?
Yeah, what we
It's like
what
a menu
got?
Of what we might talk about. Okay, this is what I've written down about Please Please Me. I've written down Rosebud, Panto, R&B, The Shirelles, Harmonies, Orgasms, Sugar Puffs, Buying LPs, Conceive / To Me, Boys - Gender, Anna - V Bobby V.
That sounds like my Christmas present list. And today we're going to be discussing the Beatles' debut album, Please Please Me. So first of all, why did you pick this one?
Well, actually, after doing A Hard Day's Night with you, having so much fun, I guess I was partly surprised at how so many people are doing the much later albums and the solo albums, when it seems to me the early albums are the ones that are full of the most joy and beauty. And I also said on Twitter to you that if I thought about the album I listen to most often and I put on, and I've got, I brought in my vinyl copy, which I must have bought in the 90s because it's got, on the back it tells you that it's available in cassette and CD.
Yeah.
This would be the first Beatles album I would just put on. If I just wanted something nice to listen to, I'd just put this on. And I think it's just a beautiful listen. And in the end, isn't that what pop music is supposed to be
Absolutely.
About? And then also, I think the thing I said about why I think I like it best, in a way, even though, as you know, I think A Hard Day's Night is probably their greatest album, it's like I like the idea of the bud before the full bloom, because there's all the promise of what's to come. And for me, I've always preferred it. I've always preferred just on the cusp of opening up.
Yeah. 90% of this album was recorded in one day, which you know.
What's the 10% that wasn't?
It was, there's four songs that weren't. I was rubbish at maths.
That's not 10%.
I think 10...
4 out of 14 is nearly a third.
Oh, is it? Oh, I told you I was rubbish at maths.
Okay, I did not know that. I always thought it was like all done in afternoon.
No, they broke it up. They had three sessions. There was one from 10 till 1, then they had some lunch, and then 2:30 to 5:30, tea, and then 7 till 10 p.m., supper.
Gosh, they would work that late.
Yeah, and John Lennon had a unique thing about this album that you'll never hear on any of the others. John Lennon had stinking cold.
Oh, and his throat was going. Yes, no, you can tell. And that's one of the reasons it's great, because you have all those lovely harmonies. And you have this kind of growling throat that's kind of growing. One, two, three, four! Well, she was just 17. Did you know what I mean? And the way she looked was way beyond compare. So how?
Track one, I saw her standing there.
Well, can we talk about, would they have come up with this track order in advance?
Possibly, I'd say George Martin would have had that, wouldn't he? Yeah.
Because the other thing we should talk about at some point is, I haven't exactly met George Martin, but I did sort of meet him at an event at Air Studios.
Wow.
Rolf Harris was there too.
Oh, hen.
And Princess Anne. But also I interviewed Bernard Cribbins when George Martin died.
All right.
About what it was like working with him and why he was a master. And I think there's a whole thing about being a novelty record man, but also knowing how to get the best out of your performers, whether they were novelty acts or not. And I suppose, in a way, the Beatles must have been a novelty act to him.
Yeah.
These four young boys.
Yeah.
You know, mucking around.
What did Bernard say?
He said one of the things was to get in, to move in close to the microphone when you wanted to create intimacy. And I know it seems obvious, but actually moving in closer, which I think affected you mentally as well, in terms of you put something a bit more intimate into the mic. And then if you go and listen to, there's a great Best of Bernard Cribbins album. And, you know, people think of just the novelty records, you know, Right Said Fred, and, well, they're all novelty records. But he did some really beautiful covers of, like, show tunes. There's some covers of I've Grown Accustomed to Her Face from My Fair Lady.
Oh,
and
really?
I remember, yeah, I'll tweet a link to the interview on Front Row that we ran. But you realise, one, Bernard Cribbins is an amazing actor. I think it's his 19th birthday as we're speaking. But just there's something about being an all-round entertainment man and then put together with the right kind of entertainment producer, which can produce a record that has sincerity to it, even though he's a comedian.
Yeah. It's strange that George Martin, the studio wizard, the first thing he did on the very first Beatles album was edit the 1, 2, 3, 4 from a different take of onto the original one. So already George Martin is the powerhouse that he came to be with the Beatles.
They always have difficulty with is getting my head round. Is it just brilliant because it's brilliant, or have I also absorbed a certain amount of the deference that's grown around this record? And I've been reading the sleeve notes on the back, you know, which are written by Tony Barrow, PR, who is obviously, you know, quite super enthusiastic and building them up and hyping them. But what an opening track, you know. And as I say, Tony Barrow says that on the sleeve, but I think it sounds like, you think it does sound like an explosion into your world.
Yeah. It sounds like a cover already, you know. But they've been playing it so many times at the Cavern. I mean, they were tight.
So it's a kind of live album in a way, when you think about the speed at which it's recorded, which is part of the power. But also, you know, she was just 17. There's something quite authentic about the world that they, I mean, what are they, 21?
Oh, if that.
You know.
Yeah.
There's nothing creepy about these lyrics. They're talking about a world of teenagers that they've been living in.
And they're speaking directly to the teenagers. Yeah. Some of that, you know what I mean.
And it's much closer to, I mean, we're going to talk, I suppose, a lot about the Brill Building and all that music of the late 50s, early 60s, which was aimed at this new consumer, the teenager. But it's done with sincerity, but it's done with some rawness too, you know. And I think that's why it's such a powerful opening track. But also the woo, which is straight away, it's the Beatles' distinctive sound.
Yeah.
You know, the early sound.
They've already got it. The bass, he admitted that he took from Talking About You, Chuck Berry's song.
I was going to say Chuck Berry.
Yeah.
Yes, you can hear it without even knowing what song it is.
Big time, yeah.
Yeah.
And also, that got me thinking, I was listening to Roll Over Beethoven, and you can hear Paul trying not to play the do-do-do-do-do-do-do, but a few slip in. He can't help himself. As soon as the rock and roll beat kicks in, that's his chosen bass riff.
Presumably there were loads of other bands doing this kind of combination of drawing on American rhythm and blues. But it is that whole sense of that first track as well. It's like plugging in a machine that's already perfectly working, the four of them. Even though, what does Ringo get to? Do you shake a tambourine on this album?
No, he plays drums.
He plays drums.
There's only a couple he doesn't play on, which we'll come to, which he's still very angry about.
I don't blame him.
Understandably,
I'm a huge fan of Ringo.
Yeah.
So I used to live in Marylebone, which you may remember I told you last time, and the year my building had closed down by the late 90s, I think mid-90s, but they hadn't sold it, so it was derelict, and it's on Manchester Square, and I remember walking there the first time when I was just getting to know the neighbourhood, and it was also that time when Britpop was really big, so there was a renewed fascination with the Beatles, and looking down into this, you know, corner where all this history had taken place, and you can't see the staircase from the street, but as a child I had the Red and the Blue albums. I think a lot of kids who grew up in the 70s did, and of course they used that image, didn't they? And then they replicated it for the Blue album when they're much older, and there's something about I don't know, it's partly there's a visual effect of the staircase apparently disappearing into infinity, but there's also this idea of so a kind of science fiction element to where might they go. You know, there's a sense of time travel.
Yeah, yeah.
Who are these four people in the staircase, which you know hundreds and hundreds of acts have gone on before and since. And they owned the staircase so much so that when they left, I mean, I don't know when they ripped that staircase out and moved it. And in fact, where is that staircase? Is it in their new headquarters?
Oh, someone's going to own that. Someone would have bought
that. Well, EMI took it with them because it was to be, in that dreaded word, iconic. But you'd have to build something around it, wouldn't you? To hold it. But I just love the idea that a staircase can, you know, when used in the right way, can have that power. And the other thing that always fascinated me on the cover was it looks like Ringo's plucked his eyebrows, which seemed unlikely.
It does, doesn't
just
it?
Just his left eyebrow.
Yeah, possibly.
And he's still got that kind of full on.
Actually, he used to have a grey streak, didn't he? He used to dye his hair, so maybe it was a grey streak in his eyebrow.
Oh, I see.
Don't know.
But Ringo seems to have changed a lot in his physical appearance because he's still a real rockabilly guy, isn't he, in the late 50s,
early
60s?
Well, he just joined them, hadn't he? Because he'd had a quiff and he'd only just started combing his hair over
for
the Beatle
cut. Yeah, he looks a bit grey there, doesn't he?
Yeah. But Angus McBean, who took the cover, he was literally roped in at the last minute. I think it was a quick phone call, can you do this album cover? And that was it.
Yeah, well, it's also, you know, there were so many school buildings and things like that. You know, it's got that, it's one of those post-war 50s buildings. There's, you can see there's bits of those new materials and there's glass and it's and those sharp angles. So it sort of looks like a building we've all been in. It looks like a school building.
And they look so happy.
And they do look
so
like a bunch
excited.
Of schoolboys on their last day.
Yeah, yeah.
Or their first day.
Yeah, it's their first day, isn't it?
It's their first day at school. It's lovely.
The world is treating me bad. Misery. I'm the kind of guy who never used to cry. The world is treating me bad. Misery.
Track two, Misery.
So this is when you realise it's the harmonies. Mm. That's part of what makes this magnificent for me. It feels like it's not quite Bach's Magnificat, but there's this choral magnificence about how beautiful they sound. How far would they have worked out those harmonies themselves? Because certainly Tony Barrow implies they did.
Yeah, they would have been doing that. I think that's we were talking with John Morris and Jason Hazlin, and again, they know Lewison as well, and he was saying, you know, the Beatles, they never really had a drummer. They had a few, like Tommy Moore and Pete Best and all these sort of vague drummers, but they were a guitar band who did harmonies.
Yeah.
It was only when the drummers came in at the end, Ringo, that suddenly you had these beautiful girl group harmonies
and that's the thing. They are proper girl group harmonies.
Yeah.
And it's very fashionable now, isn't it, to talk about gender. But even at the time, I think there was a lot of thing about how they were feminised because they had that kind of long hair. By what standards?
Yeah.
But I think it's part of that appeal, and so much of the music of that era. And I do think of Bobby V, and I think of all the kind of teeny male pop idols. They were approachable. They were slightly feminised.
Yeah.
And in a really positive way.
Yeah, it was all very Americanised, wasn't it? Though it was that kind of over too much sheen almost.
Some of it was, and with sensible cardigans and things.
Yeah, yeah. This was written for Helen Shapiro.
Did she record it?
She didn't. Her manager didn't think it was appropriate, apparently, the lyrics. Misery. But, yeah, Kenny Lynch took it. He grabbed it with both hands. I think it was a very, very minor hit. But Kenny Lynch is the first person ever to do a cover of a Beatles song. And they were on tour with him as well, and he used to play it when they were on tour. And I think Paul McCartney said, yeah, it's all right.
But the harmonies are so beautifully constructed. Is that three of them singing or four of them?
Yeah. John and Paul, definitely.
Yes, the sort of humming thing. And then you've got that nice, what is that? It sounds like a piano, but it's not a piano. The George Martin thing.
They recorded it with the tape running at double speed because they obviously had very limited equipment because George knew he was going to overdub this ding da ding da ding da ding ding ding, which he did a few days later. That moment that comes in, it just lifts it to another.
Yeah, and it sounds a bit like Bells. I mean, it sounds a bit like a Christmassy album, doesn't it?
And it's going to be a drag. That's the line Paul used when John died. The day John died, he came out and all he could say was, it's a drag.
Oh.
And all the press just tore into him saying. But I think that was just a phrase they used.
Yeah, and I suppose it's only when you use it and it has meanings that are your own.
Yeah.
That you can work out how much emotion there might be lurking beneath it.
Set you free, go with him. Go with him.
Anna, go to him. This is the first cover.
Oh, what a lovely rhythm. I think that this run of songs in the middle of side one, Misery, Anna, Chains, they're particularly harmonious.
Yeah.
And they do sound to me like girl group songs
being
flipped, even though Anna. Yeah. Anna isn't written for...
No, Arthur Alexander,
But it's also, it's one of those songs, it's got one of those stories, which is a very Bobby V kind of story, which is quite elaborate, which is about, you know, some kind of... Is there a word for the songs where one guy's talking to another guy about a girl and sort of saying, you know, she can go to you, but I'll have her back. But they're sort of for the consumption of women, aren't they? Mm. They're for young women to feel that they might be so desired, that there'll be multiple suitors.
Yeah.
Yes, there's something of the world of trying to think of historical fiction about that, you know, the kind of the young woman who is the object of everyone's desire. Yeah. And it's completely innocent. But the harmonies are just exquisite.
They are.
And that, what's the rhythm of it? It's a lovely lolloping rhythm.
I'm doing it. It sounds like hip hop when I'm doing it. So the Beatles invented hip hop.
And it speeds up a bit, but it's basically like, it's sort of like a slow dance.
Oh, yeah, definitely. And they would have been hanging around ballrooms and.
You know what? You feel this is where you'd go out to a ballroom. You go to the Mecca or the Roxy, all those places that are long gone, but it kind of exist on celluloid until it's like Billy Liar, and it's. Yeah, it's that turning point in the evening when you start to slow it down.
All the guys on that side, all the women on that side.
By that point, I think you probably picked your girl like you're playing to snog. but I just think it's a beautiful, these three songs in a row segue quite exquisitely.
And John's obviously is cold. His cold was really kicking in this time. So his voice, he just doesn't sound like this on any other records.
And maybe that's another reason I like it, because it's so raw.
Yeah.
And contrast so much with the really sweet. I mean, I think that's the word I'd use. The arrangements are really sweet. Yeah. Maybe that's where some people don't like it. They think it's too gooey. But I think it's the contrast that it's sort of like you've got this rough of those voices and then the harmonies.
Chains, my baby's got me locked up in chains. And they ain't the kind that you can see. Whoa, these chains of love got a hold on me, yeah.
So we move on to the Brill Building with Chains.
Oh, okay.
George.
Is this George?
Yeah, you should know this.
I do, I just forgot. I love this song. Even though when you stop and think about it, there's something of the controlling abuse element to the idea of being controlled by invisible chains.
Oh.
I mean, what I found fascinating about songs of this era is they're incredibly sweet and they're innocently meant, but actually if you overthink them, very quickly you can get into some really dodgy, slightly stalky material. And in this case, it's the controlled talking about being held in place. But it's a lovely George vocal.
Oh,
there's a rawness to him. And you were just saying it's like a swing rhythm running underneath it.
Yeah, I would say which Ringo would have probably just done. What I don't understand, why did George Martin think that Ringo couldn't drum? He was just phenomenal. We were just saying, the first four songs are all completely different rhythms. It's only the first one that's got a pure rock and roll rhythm. And they're veering already, skipping from genre to genre, aren't they? In four songs.
What's that? What do you call that transition bit when it kind of, when they're going do 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 do, and then it moves off into the next bit of thing?
Pickety third.
No! Don't just play random things.
I don't know.
But it's like a little transition, isn't it?
Yeah.
When
do,
they
do, 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 do.
And
there
then
will
it
be
sets
a
off again. There's a technical word for it. I thought someone you would know
tweeting.
These things because you're a guy
no.
doing a whole podcast about Beatles
God,
albums. So is this the Shirelles?
No, this was the Cookies.
So another
Little Eva's backing band. Yes, another girl band,
Maybe, again, it's another reason why I really love this album, is that even before I knew anything about the songs other than they were covers, because they're songs that were written for African-American girl bands, straight away you're not hearing just four white guys from Liverpool.
No.
You're hearing much more complexity.
Yeah.
You know, it's a gender-fluid album.
It is.
Ahead of its time.
One thing I love about it as well, obviously written by Goffin and King, and as we'll find out later, this album has got songs by Lennon McCartney, Carole King and Burt Bacharach.
Yes.
It's like, wow.
And that's a really good university challenge question, is, you know, what's the Burt Bacharach song that the Beatles
absolutely
covered,
we'll come to
early
that
on? You know, there's this whole thing about the relationship of R&B bands of the 60s, British R&B bands, and black music. And I remember, I don't know if you can remember this, in the early 90s, BBC Two did a series where they did little half-hour documentaries about different 60s bands. They did one on the Animals, they did one on the Kinks, they did one on the Yardbirds. And I remember watching the Animals one where, you know, even more so, they were doing kind of raw R&B and were selling it back to white Americans. And I think there's this real uncomfortableness, quite rightly, in the way people look at this music history and think, well, why were white Americans, especially in the South, happy to buy it from white Brits?
Yeah.
And yet they it was their own homegrown music.
Yeah.
And I remember Eric Burdon being interviewed and him talking about going on tour to America and being so horrified And I remember because Eric Burdon had had a black girlfriend in Newcastle as well, and going on their tour and going to places in the South and being told, well, you can't stay in the same hotel with your black, you know, I don't know who was on their entourage, but and segregated audiences. And I can't remember what they ended up doing, but I remember him talking about how shocked he was. And I think there's this, that's part of what's weird about this period in time, that you have so many bands which are sincere. They're really sincere in their love, and they're touring with people like Mary Wells and stuff, aren't they?
Yeah, of course.
Once they break big. So there's no sense of appropriation. But it's done in respect, and it's you're learning something from it, and you're assimilating it into something new. And I just find it really interesting. I think the Beatles did that completely respectfully. But I think in terms of American consumption, it must have been weird for African-American audiences and musicians to see their music suddenly have a value.
I wonder if George Martin had quite a bit of influence on that, because you think Elvis, when he started, that's exactly what he was doing.
Yeah.
And then the record producers and the record companies say, well, soften it down a bit, and then it just got a bit fluffy and light. And then all the Bobby V characters, they kind of copied that bit of Elvis rather than the original Elvis, where he was doing, you know, That's All Right Mama and all these.
Though, again, I always think, you know, we sort of can sneer. I don't blame the artists, but one of the people I really would love to have interviewed, I'd love to have interviewed Bobby V. He died a couple of years ago. It's one of my big regrets. I always wanted to pitch a documentary about him, because, you know, people at Gene Pitney were writing songs for Bobby V. I think Gene Pitney wrote Rubber Ball. And so there's a huge overlap and a huge sort of enrichment that goes on between the Brill Building and some of the kind of white new stars, and then some of the African-American stars.
Yeah.
And in a sense, they're all recording the same kinds of songs. So we could have an argument about which is more authentic and where the roots of it lie. But there was also a kind of racial harmony going on in the Brill Building, wasn't there, about great music was great music. And those girl bands in particular had huge status. And they were adored by people like the Beatles. They were adored in Britain in the late 50s, early 60s.
Yeah. They could replicate it as well.
Yeah. My girl says when I kiss her lips, get the thrill through.
Move on to Boys by Ringo.
I love this song.
It's a bundle of joy.
Apparently the reason they didn't swap it to Girls was because Boys rhymed with Bundle of Joy.
Yeah. What would they have done?
Yeah.
A bag full of pearls?
Girls. I don't know. But I think that's one of the, again, another reason I love this song is that there's an archness to it. So he's singing it to me in, like he has a certain distance from the song. It feels to me in a really positive way, like Ringo is reading the words and singing this, but having a lot of fun. And he's got an almost sort of operatic voice. There's a kind of echoey effect to how it sounds. But that he's singing it about boys as if he's a girl. Of course, I know probably now you can... There are probably gay fans who read a whole new thing into it. But it's just charming. I love the idea of not gender swapping a song to make it match your gender. Why not just sing it the way it was written?
Yeah, absolutely. It's much more fun. And you've got them backing him up as well. When Ringo sings and the boys back him up, and they're, boys. It's just the front cover, isn't it? They're like, we're here. And insouciant, I guess, is the word.
I'm still trying to square the idea of this really rough, leather-clad band who are doing all those Nights at the Reaper Barn, with the fact that this is quite a clever flip of African-American girl band. And they're basically being a girl band.
Yeah, they are.
They're sounding quite rough. And I think it's brilliant. It sort of pulls off. It's both at the same time because of the rawness of the vocals.
Yeah.
Did they feel happy or did they feel they'd been forced into doing stuff they didn't like?
I think they had a lot more say because the Decca tapes, Brian Epstein was very forceful, saying you've got to do all these very lightweight songs. I think they had a lot more input into this because all the other bands, all the Jerry and the Pacemakers and the hundreds of Merseybeat bands were doing all Chuck Berry and Little Richard songs. Just talking about it too, I've never thought about it before, but yeah, the diversity of the... Well, it's not that diverse, it's just girl bands. That's all they were doing. But I bet no other Merseybat band were doing that at the time.
See, and again, I wonder if that's one of the reasons why a lot of sweeping statement here. Lots of guys think they like the later albums better because there is something quite feminised about the choice of songs on this.
Yeah. And I think, wasn't it David Quantick on Twitter, I think he was talking to you about it, saying, you know, later on it's the boys like it because they're all hairy.
It's quite a simplistic reason to like it.
No, it
certainly gets more complex.
I think you look at the footage, and in the Rain video, for example, they look so cool, and that is Britpop, that is Oasis, that is everything. Yes. Prior to that, it's Screaming Girls, so you think, well, take that. So you didn't take that really seriously.
Well, did we talk about this? There's something about what happens when you have Screaming Girl fans, and it either gets they either get written out of history. So with David Bowie, all the girl fans got written out of history. You may have talked about this before. But the other example, I interviewed a couple of Duran Duran recently because they had, I can't remember why, was it a 40th anniversary thing or a new album? But they were saying that when they went to America, the police had never seen anything like the hysteria since the Beatles.
Really?
And if you look at footage, I went and looked at some of the news footage, and it was, you know, absolutely that level of intensity. But the music press by that time, the music press was very powerful by the early 80s, you know, that guaranteed that you would not be respected, because if teenage girls liked you, then it meant you couldn't be a real band. And I do think there is some misogyny in there. And in the same way, I think David Bowie, you know, all the women were written out of the history of David Bowie, and he suddenly became a thing that only guys had ever liked. But it was all the girls who were turning up at the gigs, who were on his doorstep. And so I go on about it all the time, so I made a documentary about it. But I think it's really interesting how having teenage girl fans means that male critics decide that you can't be a serious band. And the Beatles are one of the few exceptions to that.
Definitely. And again, talking to David Hepworth, who's saying the fact that we're doing this album, at the time it was, everybody bought the singles and all the EPs. The albums were, you know, Christmas presents or birthday presents. That was it. Nobody really, an album was just a collection of songs that no one could really afford.
Is this one of the first albums, then, that kind of creates the idea of buying an album by a band as opposed to just buying a succession of singles?
I don't know, because the cover alone is just, you know, it's an advert, isn't it, really? It's a...
Yes, and it says With Love Me Do, which is obviously the hit...
Yeah.
The first...
That was the first single, yeah.
First single.
It's kind of like, I don't think they went to... I think they just wanted to get some songs out, an album's worth of songs. I think George Martin had about 400 quid to play with to get those songs done. And I think it was just... content.
Yeah.
The early Beatles are now coming back into fashion. Obviously, Britpop kicked off with all the psychedelic Beatles, so they gained a whole new fan. So now people are discovering this early stuff. I haven't listened to this album for so long prior to doing this, and it's blowing my mind.
It came out when I did the Hard Day's Night one with you, was how many people came out and said, actually, the early albums are the ones that are full of joy, and you could argue that they are the best ones because they're the Beatles as a pop group.
Yeah, maybe it's just social
media. I don't
think
you have to choose. You don't have to choose.
I love you, cause you tell me things I want to know, and it's true that it really only goes to show that I know that I should never, never, never be blue.
Then we move on to Ask Me Why.
I love this song, and there's a few different reasons. One is I love that it rhymes conceive, which I think is quite sophisticated. Mm. So believe me and conceive.
Yeah, I can't believe.
But the kind of weird woo-woo-y harmonies, which are almost Mike Flowers pops, aren't they, in their extravagance? But they're just, it's unashamed about the joy of harmonies. And I don't know, if would that have been a George Martin thing? Were they performing the song live?
Yeah, they did this at the Star Club. They did it in Hamburg. And it was so tight. If you hear the Star Club tapes, it's identical to the album version.
I think it's because it's actually incredibly clever. So you know, if you've ever taken four felt-tip pens, taken the lid off them and held them together in a line, and you've drawn really beautiful shapes, that's what they're doing with harmonies.
You're very good at this.
Thank you.
It is, isn't it? Yeah. And it's so... they're fully formed.
Yeah, it's like a kind of a curvaceous rainbow just spiralling off. And they're in perfect... they're always the same distance apart. There's one other thing in it. The I. What a great way. I don't know how many other songs have done that. It's not an I. It's an I. It's... they're all distinct. Sorry, I might be overthinking this. But it's a really lovely vocal device. I think what he does with his voice, John's voice, I perhaps appreciated anew listening to this album, because its rawness actually brings out what's unique about his delivery. And there is that arrogance that I think you can hear in there. I think there is a bit of aggression. And all those things which later become quite difficult issues in his personal life, musically, are why he's utterly fascinating.
And compositionally, it's so advanced. There were no other bands around writing songs per se, but writing them to that standard. If you pick it apart, it's got all these different elements in it. It's not just a three-chord wonder.
Well, there's a point where, you know, it sort of splits off and you almost think the song could go in three different directions. And I'll never see you again. And then you just feel that song could just split off and it could meander off into three different ways. So it feels quite... There's a sense of improvisation in it, even as it's incredibly tightly harmonied. And it's got an easy listening element to it, which doesn't sound cheesy. It sounds entirely controlled. And I don't think any other band could pull that off.
Final track on side one, which was Please Please Me.
Okay. I have a theory, which is they end each side with an orgasm.
Right.
Would you like me to talk you through this?
Yeah.
Okay. So Please Please Me has a whole twist and shout kind of build.
Yeah.
There's the whole come on, come on. You know, it's to me, there's something building to an orgasmic experience, I think, musically.
Yeah.
I mean, you start with the fanfare at the beginning of this track. It sounds like, again, it sounds to me, I think of Bach, I think of trumpets, kind of announcing the arrival of these sex gods. What is that at the beginning? You know.
That's, the instrument?
Yeah.
That's a harmonica.
It is a harmonica, yeah. Is it anything else? Because it's like...
It's a harmonica. Yeah, sorry, it's a harmonica and a guitar solo at the same time, overdubbed.
Oh, so it's overdubbed. Because I think there's a whole Phil Spector-ish effect. Because it's sort of... you know, like if you have, what do you call it, when you record something too loud and it goes into...
Distortion.
There's something distorted, isn't there, which is a very full spectre effect. So it has an almost brassy fanfare announcing their arrival. And then you've got that the guitar underneath it. That one. You know, these are all, they're kind of, I think they're all sort of element that suggests sexual swagger. I'm not trying to overthink this for the sake of it. I just listening to it, and because I listen to it on vinyl, which I think is such a thing you lose when you only hear it on streaming. So if you're just aware that Please Please Me is the end of side one, it's actually really brilliantly structured album because it kind of goes into this kind of girl group segue of quite gentle, beautiful songs, and then it ends with this very, very orgasmic male sort of swagger at the end of side one, and it does the same at the end of side two. And the fanfare at the beginning of the track, and it's the title track of the album, of course. It is like it's announcing their arrival.
Yeah, big time.
On Earth.
So all the other songs on side one are the seduction, and this is the...
Yeah, well, some of them, yes, you know, you could see it as an album about courtship. It's a very late 50s, early 60s idea of courtship. So you have the more shy songs and they're talking about, oh, does he like me? Does she like me? You know, I'd have her back. You know, I'm miserable. And then it ends with, you know, something more earthy.
Because there were rumours that this song was about fellatio. These were doing the rounds
a
while ago.
Do you know, it's funny to say that because I thought that as well, just listening to it.
Filthy mind.
Please please me like I please you.
Yeah.
Well, not fellatio then, just it's about mutual oral pleasuring is what you're talking about, Chris.
Wow. It's getting hot in here.
I think I kept the tone high.
You did.
Yes, you can have a... it's rude, but it's great. I mean, you know, it'd be interesting if you were a teenager who bought this and you came home in 1962 and you thought, I've bought this Beatle album, and you put it on. I wonder what your parents would have heard on a track like that.
Yeah.
Because it sounds like, you know, it sounds a bit raunchy, but I don't think it's explicit unless you want it to be. And I think it's as explicit as you want it to be, which is why I think it's so fun. You know, so for teenagers.
Oh,
also,
course.
come on. If a guy you really fancy said, come on, just in general, it just as a phrase, it's a fascinating phrase.
Yeah.
You want to move me on really quickly?
No,
don't you?
I'm just trying to think of... There's another line where John's going, come on, come on. Oh, no, it's a bootleg. Yeah, that's all right. I'll ruin the moment.
And then it goes up to really angelic harmonies. And I know this slightly dates it, but we are speaking around the Christmas period. And I do think this album is like Advent. And so I see all these Bach-like, you know, sort of a celebration of the arrival of this godlike entity on Earth, which is the Beatles. Mm. And you have this brass-like introduction to that track. And there's that, please, please me, woo, and they go up, you know, it's like a harmony of angels.
They've introduced themselves as they would if they were playing live, so each track has got to be a bam in your face. And the whole thing as a structure is, that's them, here we are, you know. It's a live gig.
And crucially, it's that double level. So it's a live gig and it's a studio album. But it's also, they're lovely boys who your parents would like, but they're also...
saucy.
No, not saucy. Well, wild. You know, they're you know, they're Liverpool boys. I mean, I'm sure in sort of home counties, middle-class homes, they'd have probably been appalled at the idea of these northerners daring to be, you know, hugely successful.
House.
I'm sure that was a lot of snobbery about the MBE, wasn't it? Like, how dare these, you know, whether they were working class or middle class or not, I think there was just that whole snobbery about people who didn't know their place.
By which time, everybody knew who they were. And they knew they had these so-called northern accents, which I think they put on a bit anyway. But, some of the reactions, they're hilarious. These old boys... But they played up on that prior to that in Hard Day's Night, didn't they? When they're in the train.
The one says, I fought the war for your sort.
Yeah. I bet you wish you never bothered.
Oh, I bet you're sorry you won.
That's it.
I know now, because there's all this obsession with, you know, being offensive and getting kind of called out on Twitter and, you know, people find it really aggressive. It's so interesting if you look back at the 60s and how flippant people were. So if you see a film like Billy Liar where... Tom Courtney and Rodney Bewes, when they come out on their lunch break, they have this little joke routine they do on the war memorial. And they kind of high kick their way down it. And I don't think you could shoot something like that now. People would say that's hugely disrespectful, but they were doing that in the early 60s. And the closer we were to the war, the easier it was to have fun with it, even if it would have offended some people. I mean, it was okay to put that in a mainstream film. And I kind of feel the Beatles' defiance is quite amusing in the same way.
Someone to love.
We're flipping over to side two with Love Me Do, debut single.
I love that pause in the middle of the song. Mm. Do. It's quite slow, isn't it?
Yeah, it's quite heavy.
It's a slow, heavy swagger. So I wonder if this is a song that works better live, because I have to be honest, even though it's their first single and it's this huge moment in rock music, it's not my favourite track on the album. And I love every track on this album, but to me it's probably the one...
Well, there was a song around at the time, wasn't it? Like, hey, baby. And it was around that sort of time. So it had that swing. I remember in 1983, I think it was, they had an open day at Abbey Road where you could go around the studio. And they had this film footage of basically stuff that probably ended up on Anthology. And they played this, and it must have been the mono version. And it was the most powerful... That was the one song I came out thinking, wow, I love that song so much. I've heard it and always dismissed it. You turn it up loud, and you can imagine them playing that in the Cavern or some of the smaller venues.
I think when you play a song that slow, everything relies on the power, the kind of charismatic power of the band performing it. Mm. And I think the idea of seeing them perform this live is actually more exciting to me than hearing it on the album, because I think... Yeah, it would be quite something to see them, because it's slow and deliberate and they'd be holding you with it. Lyrically, it's not the most interesting. And musically, it's not the most interesting, am I fair?
Yeah, I think the Ruttles took the mick out of
this. What's the Ruttles?
It was, number one.
Oh, yes, which is quite monotonous, isn't it?
Yeah, one of mine is two. Yeah, they are literally tearing it to shreds. I do love, though, that you can hear it sort of evolving, because Ringo's... on tambourine on that version.
That's the one where he's given a tambourine to rattle. That was the line in the Ray, is it in the Roy Carr book? You know, the Beatles, an illustrated record. And I think there's a photograph of the session, and I just always remember the caption, which was, you know, they recorded it in a day. Probably not quite true. Sorry if I've misremembered it, Roy Carr. And, you know, Ringo was given a tambourine to rattle. I always remember that, being given a tambourine to rattle, which sounds so demeaning.
It's almost throwing it at him.
Yes.
There you go, Ringo.
Like being the dunce in the class, which is so unfair.
Yeah, but he's... there's three different versions. So on the Anthology, you can hear Pete Best doing it.
Ooh.
Which is interesting, because it's interesting. Have a listen, see what you think. That's all I'll say. Yeah, and then you've got Ringo. They redid it with Ringo on drums, which was originally the single version, and then they eventually replaced it with the Andy White version, which is the one on the album.
Oh, that's Andy White. Is that he, the guy who joined them?
No,
that was Dez. Was there a drummer who joined them in Holland when Ringo got flu?
Jimmy Nicol,
thank you.
Yeah, I'll get there eventually.
Thank you.
Yeah, but I think Andy White does a good job on it.
Well, I think Ringo should know, I'm sure he already does know, that it's not the most interesting track on the album. So the one track not to be on, not a bad thing. Well, he's not on several others too.
Well, the next track.
Oh dear.
P.S. I Love You. Treasure these few words till we're together. Keep all my love forever. P.S. I Love You.
Actually, the drumming isn't that important on this either.
It's not.
So it's interesting that he's not on the track, so the drumming isn't that important.
Yes. He's on maracas on this one.
It's like an episode of Play School, isn't it? Where he's holding different percussion instruments. I always wanted the triangle. Oh, Paul McCartney sounds so swoony on this. I can completely put myself in a time machine and go back to the early 60s and see myself completely swooning at the way he sings.
He's got a rose in his mouth.
He's got a whole croony thing that draws on the spirit of Frank Sinatra.
It's weird because John was saying that he said he was trying to write a song called Soldier Boy by the Shirelles.
Oh, yeah. Soldier boy. Do, 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 do. And it sort of, it has a little prologue. Do, 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 do. I'll be true to you. You were my first love. And you'll be my last love. There it goes on from there.
Oh, it's very simple.
I can't do the rest.
I'm just doing loads of reverb and put some piano.
I have an album called Girls on Top, which is a compilation of a load of the great girl bands of the early 60s, which I have listened to a lot.
Yeah.
I'll be true to you. But that sounds much more like a traditional folk song that has been turned into a thing. This doesn't sound like that.
That's what John said.
It's in the spirit of. I mean, again, we go back to this thing about the feminized girl band sound of this album, which is, it definitely sounds like a boy band version of a girl band song. And there's a whole thing about love letters, which, I mean, Pat Boone and all the rest of it, which is a whole lost art of courtship. So it has an additional nostalgia value now, doesn't it?
Yeah,
because right up into the 80s, I don't know, do people send love letters anymore? I remember getting love letters in the 80s when I was at university, but into the early 90s. But once the internet really took off, it's all text now, isn't it?
Yeah, where's the romance in that? But lol.
Well, David Cameron thinks that means lots of love.
Oh, does he? Oh, that could be awkward. Really?
Yeah, do you not remember?
No.
Lol is actually one of the great acronyms of modern life. I love lol. Yes, because I like that you can say it out loud. You know, at something that's kind of, you know, you want to say.
So rather than laugh, would you go lol?
Sometimes if it's like, you know, it's something that's kind of dryly witty, you might kind of go lol in a kind of ironic way.
Yeah.
It works for me.
All right. Yeah, roffle.
I'm so glad the Beatles weren't coming together in the era of texting. Man. Can you imagine?
Oh.
God, that's the thought. You know, like if you had a time machine, you could really mess with time. You would move the Beatles so that they found themselves in the 2000s.
Yeah, P.S.
on Instagram.
P.S. I Heart You.
It is a good song.
Very advanced as well.
So how is it advanced?
Well, the chord-wise, again, it's most of other bands were writing pure rock and roll three-chord blues. This is another level, you know. It's got sort of Hollywood sort of musical chord changes to it. He would have been 19, 20.
But he liked to show tunes, didn't he, Paul? And you think about the cover of Till There Was You from The Music Man. I love that cover.
Yeah.
I think, I don't know, am I right in thinking it's Paul? Because you think later on with Sergeant Pepper, he's the one who's going out and picking up on all this avant-garde music. He seems to be the one who draws most on the whole range of music. And I suppose this is a good point to bring in my reference to Panto. So I was thinking, but this album is also that time when pop groups were still very much tied into the variety world of entertainment. And although they didn't do a Panto as such, they did this Christmas show, didn't they? 63, 64, where they wouldn't Panto costumes. And I was thinking of, you know, the London Palladium, which has now started reviving pantos again, you know, big budget ones. But they had these ones from 64 to 66 with Cliff Richard and the Shadows. And I know Cliff Richard and the Shadows weren't cool by then in the way that the Beatles were, but they were a huge rock band of the early 60s and very influential. And I think it's interesting that position of the Beatles, like on Walker and Wise as well, and on the Variety, the Royal Variety Show, that they seem to ride this interesting route between being quite, you know, the rough clubbing band and the acceptable band that was embraced by sort of the establishment.
Yeah.
And they're doing it from quite early on.
Well, that was as big as they could have got, wasn't it, at the time, really, in the UK? Before they started thinking of America.
Well, it's what makes you huge, isn't it? Because you need everyone buying your records. I mean, suppose teenagers were a huge demographic then. They were a huge demographic. But being on national television, where you have this mass audience seeing you, would have been absolutely central to breaking out and becoming a massive band as opposed to just a teen phenomenon.
Sha-la-la-la-la. It's not the way you smile that touched my heart. Sha-la-la-la-la. It's not the way you kiss that tears me apart. Oh, many, many, many nights go by.
Baby, It's You, a Burt Bacharach sound.
So that's the Celesta on it.
Yeah.
Which sounds a bit like a xylophone or a glockenspiel, and then it's some kind of percussion instrument.
It's a struck idiophone operated by a keyboard. Looks similar to an upright piano, albeit with smaller keys and a smaller cabinet.
It's weird, isn't it?
Sounds like one of those kids sort of...
Yeah.
I don't know.
Well, the thing is, 5 years later, you'd be doing that with a Moog or something, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
You know, it'd have been a very obvious electronic sound. And it's not. It still sounds like an analogue sound. I love this song. Sounds like a really beautiful tribute to African-American girl bands.
Again, it's the Shirelles. They're all over this, aren't they, this album?
Yeah. And it's their take on it. And the whole sha-la-la-la-la, you can hear the Liverpudlian accent in it.
Yeah.
I just think it's completely charming.
Yeah.
Really at the time, how were they received? Was it uniformly praised, or would there have been, you know, I don't know what were the equivalent of the highbrow critics? If I suppose pop music didn't have highbrow critics in those days, did it?
Again,
who would have said, how dare they? You know, this is a poor parody of authentic black music. I wonder.
I don't think anybody would have taken it that seriously.
They wouldn't have taken it that seriously.
No,
would they?
It was only when the following album with the Beatles, when the guy in the Times critic was saying about not a second time, comparing it to these Aeolian cadences. And I think that's when people started taking notice.
Oh, but he was praising them, wasn't he? But I was just thinking, if you were to imagine this album being made now and looked through modern prison, you have really sort of highbrow, very solemn critics of rock music who would say this is cultural appropriation. I think that's what they would say about a song like
that.
I think it's completely charming because I think it's done as tribute.
Oh, yes, they love it. They're just fans, aren't they?
And I do think a lot about, because they toured with some of these groups, there was obviously huge respect, mutual admiration. And the fact that they had that friendship with Helen Shapiro, who if you listen to, I mean, some of her tracks are really interesting because she's got that sort of that big voice, but she's a young woman. And they really captured that sense of how very young adolescents have incredibly powerful emotions, which can seem massive. And if you've ever read back over your old teenage diaries, you know, it's just, I have done it, and it's quite traumatic, but it's also worth remembering how much bigger
everything
seems. So your emotional unhappiness seems much, much greater, and your desolation is much greater. And I think these songs really capture that sense of the massive size of your emotions.
It's like the big brother arm around the sister,
isn't
it?
Yeah, and it's respectful of the young person's perspective on the world.
Yes, it's not patronising at all. And
but
beautiful.
And they're beautiful and authentic, and they're not afraid to be emotional. I think that's the most important thing about this album, is that they manage to sing sincerely, even if there's a knowingness about it. So I think that the Ringo one, Boys, is the one where I think there's a sort of archness.
Yeah.
But it's still done with real sweetness. I love the fact that he sounds like he knows he's singing this song about boys.
Yeah. But it's also, this one was, again, this is the Burt Bacharach track. Again, I love the idea that Carole King and Burt Bacharach are on there. But this is the penultimate recording from the marathon session. So John's cold is really kicking in. He's on Zoob cough sweets, apparently. He's downing them all. But that adds to the, when he sings that, the bit of the middle
it's
eight.
It's just that bit,
He goes up an octave and his voice is breaking.
Something nobody can, something nobody. Do you know what he needed? He needed some of that chloroseptic. I don't know if they had it there. You know that Vicks spray?
Yeah.
It's really good. I remember having to do a speech at the University Debating Society and it just numbs it.
Really?
Completely numbs it, no matter how raw it is. And you can then just perform and you sound fine. And when it wears off, I imagine you've probably done quite a lot of damage. Oh. But he could have taken that.
He could, yeah. John, what were you thinking?
But should always carry a bottle.
He would have never sung again, surely, if he'd used it on this album.
And good, there's no harmonica on this, but there's harmonica on the one before, wasn't there? But in general, the use of harmonica on this album is really interesting because it's never overdone, and presumably it's always John, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's always a flavour, isn't it?
It doesn't sound like a kind of sailor shanty. It never outstays its welcome.
I would love to hear a Beatles shanty, a ribald shanty.
Yeah, what if you got a whole album of sea shanties?
Yeah. Yeah,
the Beatles album. And, you know, like My Bonnie could have been the first track.
Yeah.
It's not too late. Paul and Ringo.
Yeah.
You could do an album of sea shanties.
I love the idea. Ian Lee was suggesting that Paul and Ringo should do a load of Road 2 movies like Bob Hope.
Who would be the Dorothy L'Amour character? Barbara Bach, I guess.
Barbara Bach, yeah, she'd be the perfect one. But Paul would be the one that gets the girl. So,
do you know, I've never seen one all the way through. Was it always...
I think
Bing.
It was Bob Hope that. Bing was the one that always got the girl. Bob was the one a bit frustrated, but she was. I think she liked them both.
let's not pause there for too long. Let's move on. Listen.
Do you want to know a secret?
Oh, yes. Right, before I forget, that fade at the end.
Yeah.
Do, 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 do. There's a lot of that on A Hard Day's Night, isn't there?
There is, yes.
So that's the first time I really hear it. But also, it sounds like a song written to be done in a sketch with Morecambe and Wise, because you've got that really dramatic opening, you know, with a Spanish guitar. Yeah. You'll never know how much I really love you. You could just imagine Eric Morecambe walking on behind them. And then once they go off and do, the sketch would start. It's the fact that it manages to be comic at the same time as there's a kind of real drama to it. It doesn't feel like it's meant to be taken that seriously. Obviously, Do You Want to Know a Secret? It sort of undermines its own dramatic opening.
You were saying about A Hard Day's Night, the chord sequence with this is pretty well identical to the chord sequence on I'm Happy Just to Dance With You. It's the same sort of... John wrote them both, and I'm thinking, subconsciously saying, oh yeah, that's George's chords.
So you know the way it fades out? How does that chord thing go on this track? I don't know, it makes me think a bit of Things We Said to Zay. There's something about that alternating thing. It's like AC/DC.
Yeah, not the band.
The current. Yeah, so we're bringing in elementary physics here.
Wow.
So this is the one that Jerry and the Pacemakers actually had the bigger hit with it? Because did the Beatles not release this as a single?
No.
I'm sure one of the other Merseybeat bands had a huge hit.
Was it Billy J. Kramer and the Dakotas,
maybe.
I think. Oh, Billy J. Kramer and the Dakotas.
Yes, it was. Do You Want to Know a Secret? It's the first top 10 song to feature Harrison as a lead singer. Mind you, this is only Wikipedia. I don't trust Wikipedia. And it reached number 2 on the Billboard chart in 1964. So that would be in the US, they say. Well, you don't count the US charts.
They released everything, didn't they?
What do they know? Though I love George's singing.
I know, you've said before.
Yeah. No, well, I said I love George. I didn't say I always loved
his singing.
I love
his singing as
well. But I love his singing.
He sounds like a boy on this. He's so young. He just sounds like a boy. It sounds like his voice is just broken. And he's
all sound like themselves. And I know we've heard so much of their voices over the years, it's not surprising we can tell them apart at the first sound.
Yeah.
But it's just adorable.
Do they remind me, do they write the names of the singers on the...
No, they don't. They just write the names of the composers. But what they do on the sleeve notes is they tell you who sings what.
Right, because the sleeve notes are really powerful, because most people wouldn't have known which Beatle was which Beatle, would they? And fans would have wanted to know who's singing.
There's a paragraph at the end where it says, "A group's admiration for the work of the Shirelles has demonstrated the inclusion of Baby It's You, John taking the lead vocal with George and Paul supplying the harmony." So it's written in a slightly sort of pompous way.
These are the Beatles.
Yes.
So the fans knew who was the singer and they could pick the
favourite. Do you want to know
one?
A secret? Hand the audio spotlight to George, which is, you know, rather cheesy writing.
Yeah.
And yet it says there's only one trick duet, and that's on A Taste of Honey, featuring a dual-voiced Paul. George joins them for Chains, Love Me Do and Please Please Me. Yeah, so it's a bit coy. I think this is a song that the grown-ups would love, because there's something slightly gimmicky about it.
Yes.
It sounds a bit like a novelty record.
Yeah.
I don't know who would be the equivalent of singing this kind of thing. Because it's not quite Cliff Richard, who I think was still trying to do real rock songs. Yeah. It's slightly more of a like an entertainer doing a slightly gimmicky song, reaching out to the housewifey, slightly older listener.
I'm only thinking Rolf Harris now.
Don't say that.
Sort of.
Well, the Rolf Harris did some great records.
He did.
Shall I tell you my Rolf Harris?
Can you?
Well, yeah, it's not a creepy story. So I had a friend who worked for a PR company, and he invited me to go to this charity ball at Air Studios in the early 90s. Yeah. And George Martin was the host. And, it's a converted church in Belsize Park. It's stunning. It's just this huge cathedral space that you can get a whole orchestra in. And I don't know what the charity was, but Princess Anne was the guest of honour, just being the patron or something. And the after-dinner entertainment was... Rolf Harris, who had his didgeridoo, and I just remember it was not that long after he'd released Stairway to Heaven.
Oh, yeah.
And everyone was just shouting Stairway at him, but he didn't perform it. But for what it's worth, I think it's worth saying that people like him, you know, managed to be really successful and good entertainers, and none of us knew. I mean, I had no idea that he was an abuser.
No.
Though I've met people, you know, adult women who were in children's television who said, oh yeah, he was always, you know, he obviously had a reputation, including with adult women, of trying it on. I think he was, which is really depressing to hear. But we didn't know that in the early 1990s.
No.
And he was of that generation of stars who kind of were children's entertainers, did novelty records, but there was a kind of overlap.
Yeah.
With the world of variety and pop bands like the Beatles.
Yeah, and I remember the Stairway to Heaven, because didn't he play Glastonbury?
I think he did. I think he's really talented.
And he was really...
He's a really talented musician and he's a really talented painter. Mm. And that portrait he did of the Queen is actually one of the few decent portraits of the Queen that doesn't look like a child's drawing.
Yeah.
But I presume it's hidden away and it's never going to be shown in public again. Mm. I'm not sure how I feel about that. You know, if you were going to do that, then you would take down the sculptures by Eric Gill on the front of Broadcasting House, wouldn't you? Because he was known... We now know he abused his children.
Yeah.
Sexually abused them. But, you know, there they still are.
Moving on to A Taste of Honey.
How did you get there?
I don't know.
Okay, right. I'm going to talk about Sugar Puffs in a minute.
Please, somebody open a window.
That came out all wrong.
A taste of honey, tasting much sweeter than wine. Do-do-do-do.
This is not a Beatles composition, and it sounds like the theme tune to a TV Western.
It does.
Doesn't it? It has a slightly Spanishy guitar, and it sounds like you're going into a ballad story. And I remember my brother, who was born in 1963, telling me whenever we heard the song we were playing it, because my brother was a huge Beatles fan, he said it always made him think of the advert for Sugar Puffs, because they used to use this song.
Really?
As Sugar Puffs, which if you think about hearing this song, obviously covered by someone else, it's sort of like quite a dark...
Yeah,
it's not an obvious jolly jingle song for an advert. It makes you think of eating cereal in a sort of existential angst, doesn't it?
Like you do, yeah.
And I have this, and I actually tried to picture the advert in my head because my brother told me that. And so whenever I hear this song, I'm always imagining a child in a kind of in a windswept location eating sugar puffs.
I'm picturing the Honey Monster for some reason.
I think this is before the Honey Monster.
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
a taste of honey, Mummy.
Yeah, no, I think it was when you needed to have more fear of your child. If your child didn't eat...
Right.
I don't know. Or yeah, maybe there was just more literalism in 60s advertising. But that's my Sugar Puff story, that I think the song was used as a theme.
I see.
Is that George again?
No. That's Paul.
It's Paul.
That's Paul, yeah.
It's interesting because it's not as good as his own songs on this album already.
I know. They did this a lot. They did this live. I've been bleating on about the Star Club. Somebody needs to remix the Star Club and demix it and make it into stereo. They do an amazing version of A Taste of Honey.
On the bootleg?
On the Star Club.
The one that my brother fobbed me off. That must go. Right. It might be worth listening to after
all. You need to get back into that. I think he's done you a favour. It's all I listen to at the moment.
Okay.
It's brilliant.
I'm going to get out.
But it's so powerful.
But it sounds much better in that
live
recording.
Yeah. It seems that, yeah.
It's a bit insipid here, isn't it? Mm. And it's got loads of echo on it. Like, they're trying to create a sense of drama around it, the thing about the Beatles is you realise they don't need drama about them because they're not a band of drama. No. There's something approachable and accessible and down-to-earth about them, and they don't need false... You know what this reminds you of? The production on this is like, what's that song? Is that a Johnny Layton song? Johnny, Remember Me?
Yeah.
You know, the Joe Meek kind of production, which is really melodramatic.
Yeah, minor chords.
And
it's the same as Do You Want to... No, a secret. It's the same. Bring, both start with this.
Yes,
almost
but
like a
do
Western.
You know what? Do you want to know a secret? Is a winking, knowing, quite sophisticated, playful song. Whereas this has the melodrama of a Joe Meek production, which in their own ways are magnificent. But they really date in a weird way, don't they? And I suppose they're entirely contemporaneous, aren't they? 61, 2. I know Murray Melvin really well. I interviewed him and Rita Tushingham on the 50th anniversary of the film.
Did you?
Yeah, that's when I first met him. They're both wonderful. And you know what was really lovely about meeting them? Because, you know, that was their first big film and it got nominated for awards at Cannes and things and they got flown out to all these film events. And I don't think the two of them meet each other that often, but they're like, they suddenly became teenagers in front of my eyes when they met each other again. And they were remembering a story where they'd been at a party held by the British ambassador in the Prague embassy. And they were just telling old jokes about the parrot and falling down the stairs. And, you know, they were in their, I guess in their 70s. They're just wonderful.
There's a place. I love this one.
So this makes you think of the illustration from that book. You know, the one with the weird, creepy...
Oh, the Alan Aldrich one, yeah.
But the one which isn't too creepy is, I think the illustration to this is a picture of Lennon's head with his legs going back up and climbing down a staircase into his brain. I mean, it's a bit literal.
Yes.
It's not actually that great a drawing. And I think they've drawn old John as well with the glasses and the long hair. But it's a good song. And of course, it makes you think of In My Life, doesn't it?
Mm.
This idea of a retreat into safe mental spaces.
Yeah. He was always... That's what he did, wasn't he? I'm only sleeping. It was either bed or his mind. That was his go-to.
And it's that dual thing of really beautiful, angelic harmonies and then a really raw... There's a harmonica on it. There's his voice. The guitars are quite kind of heavy.
Yeah, and it's all abrasive, isn't it?
It's both... devil and angel at the same time.
It is. But was anybody else singing about this at the time? I mean, you know, going into your mind? Would that relate to a teenage fan listening to it, going into the room thinking, I go into mind.
Billy Lyre,
there you go.
That would be exact comparison, wouldn't it?
Yeah. My mate died from cystic fibrosis last year, and he picked this at the funeral. Because before he died, he didn't want to see anybody for like 6 months, and he just sort of didn't want to see anybody. And they played it at the end. It's like, whoa, okay, that's where he's been. And it was, I can't listen to it now. It's just... But it's a bit... I've always loved this song, and the harmonies are just... It's all abrasive. John's cold, his nasal twang.
And I have to say, there's a bit of the harmony that doesn't quite work, which is partly what makes it intriguing. You know, the sort of do-do-do-do, he tries to do a kind of vocal trill, and he can't quite pull it off, and it sounds a bit clumsy. But that's partly what makes it interesting, because
his voice was shot, but
yeah, Paul would have probably done it much better. But it's also what makes it interesting, because it isn't quite perfect. It feels very real.
So we end with Twist and Shout.
Let's talk about Ringo's drumming first, because yes. we can go on and on about, and obviously this is the orgasm that ends the album.
Yeah.
But tell me about the drumming, because it's such great drumming.
It's unbelievable. Ringo just pounces in at the beginning. When you hear this, you can see him bouncing along, his hair bouncing all
his
over the place.
His quiff bouncing up and down.
Yeah, it's not quite hanging. Give it another 6 months. And it's just raw energy. It's they did this in two takes, and this is the first take. I think the second one, John's voice was literally torn to shreds by then. He couldn't even sing. So they had to go with this version.
Now, I must have heard other versions of this, and I don't know how many versions there had been before they recorded it. But in terms of what they've done with it, is it pretty loyal to the original arrangement, or have they really changed it?
Well, the Isley Brothers was the sort of big one. You can't really compare them. This sounds like the Beatles in the same way that Money sounds like the Beatles,
yeah.
but Smokey Robinson, that doesn't sound like it. They just Beatlify it.
Yeah.
And it's the electric guitars, John's nasal, which is all he can do. And the tension of which, as you say, yeah, it's the same with Please Please Me.
Yeah. The other thing is, I know part of the song has a life of its own, but when it starts, it is one of those songs, you know, when you buy an album, there's only one good track on it. Obviously, this is not an album with only one good track on it. But when the most amazing track starts, it's as if the rest of the album disappears.
Yeah.
And it becomes a single.
Yeah.
Was this released as an EP?
It was, yeah, not as a single.
And, of course, there's that, you know, it was used in Ferris Bueller's Day Off, which is, what, 85, 86?
Oh, yes, yeah.
I think it's so interesting that they used this song. It wasn't an obvious thing to put on that.
No.
Film soundtrack.
I quite like that version.
Oh, it's
with all the brass.
Yeah, but don't forget, they start playing the Beatles version.
Mm.
It is the Beatles version you hear,
oh, yeah, yeah.
and then it mutates. But I think that the power of the song is captured in the way that film uses it, because it's like it's a German day parade. Mm. It's a bunch of German Americans as girls in dirndl skirts.
Yeah.
And they're doing their weird 80s version of 60s dancing on that float.
Yes.
But the moment it starts, you've tapped into something pure. And it is that idea of, you know, if you tapped into Beethoven's Ode to Joy, it's something that belongs to everybody. And I think Twist and Shout is one of those songs that, although it's not their original song, the Beatles have made it an anthem. That
Absolutely.
Is their anthem. And I think the only other song I'd put in with it, although I think Please Please Me is orgasmic in the same way, I think Twist and Shout is a better overall kind of package, She Loves You, which probably for me, I would say, is my definitive Beatles track, even though there's so many other exquisite, interesting, complicated, wonderful songs. Something about She Loves You and its purity. It's the point where the Beatles almost, their music liquefies into pure sex, I think.
Wow.
In chemistry, there are certain elements that go straight from a solid to a gaseous state. She Loves You is the equivalent of the Beatles song that goes straight from solid to gas.
Wowzers. I'm going to get my periodic table and all my chemistry books out. See what
like carbon dioxide does that.
Yeah.
Carbon dioxide snow goes straight to gas.
Yes. So She Loves You is...
is the carbon dioxide snow of the Beatles. The chemists listening to this will find that a really good
analogy. Oh, they're going to be rolling in the aisles. Overall,
yes.
How would you say this album touches you?
Well, it's the album I listen to more than any other. And it has associations. For me, it's a time travel album. I'm very fascinated by that period of the late 50s, early 60s anyway.
Yeah.
And so if you imagine, I think of this album as the rosebud before the bloom fully opens with A Hard Day's Night. And you could argue that an album like Sgt. Pepper is sort of the bloom at its fullest expanse.
Mm.
Even though I think they're all wonderful albums, there's something about the excitement of this just opening up, which excites me. And in the same way, I feel 1962 is the year that is like a rosebud of the 60s, because it's the year when all that kind of late 50s, the Two Eyes and Soho music scene is opening up into real British rock and roll. So when I listen to this album, I feel transported back in time to the beginning of something.
Mm.
And so I feel the excitement of listening to the beginning of something. And so that, in that sense, it's probably the album I listen to most. I hadn't really thought about it, and I'm not sure they're directly connected, but the process of a solid going straight to gas is called sublimation. And if you think about the notion of the sublime in art, which is, you know, God, I'm not sure I can define the sublime, even though I studied Wordsworth and did kind of all these papers on him. But the idea of, you know, that kind of moment of perfection when experience is kind of transmuted into art. That's what the sublime is, isn't it? And being touched by the sublime, being touched by this moment of perfection, whether it's in nature or music. I think there's something very interesting that two words are kind of the same, even if they're not, I don't know what the source is of sublimation. But that is how I think this album is the point when the Beatles are kind of turning into an atmosphere, aren't they?
They are.
From solid to gas.
They are.
Without a liquid state. That's how I define this album.
And you can guarantee that has never been said before.
I hope not.
Awesome. Samira Ahmed, thank you so much. It's always lovely to talk to you. And you just got a way of just making the Beatles exciting again. So thank you.
Thank you. It's been an utter pleasure.